We have, of course, talked a lot about Roe v. Wade, that 1973 Supreme Court decision that decriminalized abortion here on Issues, etc. We've talked about the ins and the outs. One of the things I don't think we've ever discussed, and we will here in the first 25 minutes of the program, is the view of women that is portrayed in the Roe v. Wade decision. Well, I think it's commonly said and perhaps commonly believed that, well, it may have been a bad decision, but it had a higher view of women than had previously been held. Is that true? Is Roe v. Wade, its view of women, better than the view of women had been before Roe v. Wade? What is Roe v. Wade's view of women? We'll be talking about that here in the first 25 minutes of Issues, etc. Paige Comstock Cunningham of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity will be our guest. Then we've got a long way to go here in 3 hours. Pam Fichter joins us of Missouri Right to Life. We'll do some Missouri election analysis. That's some local stuff, looking at the local things that occurred here last week. We'll also talk with Bill Beckman of Illinois Right to Life a little later in this hour about Illinois election analysis on the other side of the river. In the second hour of the program, Philip Karst joins us of Illinois Catholic Health Association. We're going to be talking about the ability of some federal workers in Illinois to enroll in a health plan that doesn't cover abortion, contraceptives, or fertility treatments, things that would be troublesome to Roman Catholics. We'll be talking with him in the second hour of the program. Then we'll spend some time with Seth Cooper of the Discovery Institute. You've heard about this in the news. There's a federal trial in Atlanta over the constitutionality of a disclaimer sticker in textbooks about evolution. Seth will fill us in. Then we're going to be hearing a little bit from both the president's press conference of last week, Thursday, just a snippet, and yesterday's press conference, White House press conference, over the issue of a comment that the president made when he had been mistakenly told during the press conference that Yasser Arafat had passed away. The president said, well, my first reaction is, God bless his soul. You might have read about this in WorldNet Daily. We'll be dealing with that in a little bit of open lines prior to the third hour. In the third hour, today the church remembers the late 16th century Lutheran pastor, confessor, theologian, Martin Chemnitz. He is called the second Martin after Martin Luther. We'll talk with Dr. Martin Noland, the third Martin. He's director of the Concordia Historical Institute, in the last hour of the program about this. This man, Martin Chemnitz, is probably as influential as Luther. I think it's safe to say, as influential as Luther in the ongoing Reformation during the 16th century. Second generation Reformation theologian. We'll talk about it in the third hour of the program. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We have a lot of ground to cover, so let's hit the ground running. Paige Comstock Cunningham is a senior fellow for the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity. She's author of a chapter in this book I've been recommending called The Cost of Choice. Paige's chapter is titled The Supreme Court and the Creation of the Two-Dimensional Woman. Paige, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hey, Todd. Thanks for inviting me to be on the program this afternoon.
Paige, what do you mean by two-dimensional woman?
Well, I want to get people's attention to think about what really happened in 1973, when the Supreme Court gave us abortion on demand, and then they reaffirmed it 20 years later in Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And my basic point is that in looking at abortion, the court has pretty much said that the whole issue of getting pregnant, carrying a child to term, and raising a child is the woman's responsibility and hers alone. And pretending basically that she lives in isolation, that women don't have relationships with other people, like a husband or parents or family or employer or church family. And on the other hand, it also says that none of these other institutions or individuals have any responsibility to the woman. So basically, it has isolated her, and I think made kind of a two-dimensional comic book caricature of who women really are.
So how is it that the Roe decision is not only popularly said but popularly believed to have been a major step forward for women in America?
Because they think that we need abortion in order to be on equal turf with men. And it has been said over and over again since Roe versus Wade that abortion is basically the centerpiece of women's rights and women's equality, including by one sitting justice, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She said abortion is central to a woman's dignity. So we've been told that abortion is the number one right for women, and that everything else in our lives hinges upon whether or not we have access to legalized abortion.
To flesh that out so that we understand completely what's being said in comments like that by the Supreme Court Justice, a woman's ability to, with impunity, kill her unborn child is integral to a woman's well-being, rights, full participation in society?
Absolutely. The court seems to think that that is the linchpin for enabling women to have economic equality, political equality, social equality, and certainly legal equality, but it is a big fraud. Some of your listeners may remember that back in the late 80s and early 90s, before the Supreme Court wrote the Planned Parenthood versus Casey decision, everybody was concerned that the court might cut back on abortion, that it might even reverse Roe versus Wade. And we were told over and over again that that would turn the clock back on women's rights. And that is a fraud because Roe versus Wade and abortion rights don't stand for anything other than abortion rights. The only cases that that's used for are cases involving killing, like physician-assisted suicide. But women's rights, economic rights, and ending other kinds of discrimination were already going on before Roe versus Wade, and there's not a single economic or political right that women have that depends on abortion.
Can it be argued that Roe, rather than advancing the genuine place of women in society, may have over the last 30 years hindered that progress?
Oh, Todd, I do think so, because I think what it has done is put all the risk and responsibility and rewards of children on women, and it's kind of cut men completely out of the picture, unless they are the ones who are going to pay for the abortion or get charged with paying child support for a child they didn't want. It has taken employers off the hook to have policies that accommodate the reality that women are the ones who get pregnant and bear children. It has taken schools off the hook for accommodating students who are pregnant. I mean, you could ask undergraduate students, how many have know girls that got pregnant in college? Everybody does. How many have ever seen a pregnant girl at college? Hardly anybody. Why? Because it's seen as a girl's responsibility, and her only solution is to get an abortion or to drop out of college. So it's basically saying that children don't matter to us, and the women who have children don't matter to us.
You have written that Roe v. Wade and its companion case, Roe, the Doe case,
mm-hmm.
are a anomaly in American jurisprudence, public policy, and culture. Let's start with the first one, American jurisprudence. Make the case, if you would, that you do in your article in the Cost of Choice, that in terms of the law, Roe is bad law.
Well, it is bad law for a number of reasons. First, let me just say that right after it was written, many legal scholars and academic scholars criticized it, including those who support abortion rights. But they said that's not the way to get there. It's bad law because abortion rights do not appear in the Constitution, and then the court told us that it was a constitutional right. It's bad law because the court said that abortion is a kind of privacy right, and privacy is also not found in the Constitution. The court wasn't even sure where in the Constitution they could find protection for abortion, but they were sure it was lurking in the shadows somewhere. So just as a matter of law, there's no clear legal basis or constitutional basis for saying that, yes, we have a constitutional right to abortion. You asked about the cultural anomaly of Roe, let me just talk a little about the political aspect, and that is at the time Roe v. Wade was decided, many states were wrestling with what to do with their abortion laws. Some of them were loosening the laws a little bit. Some had done that, and there were voter referendums to tighten them back up, to restrict abortion, and there was that just interplay of democracy that has been a feature of our country since its founding, where the people act through their legislators. And the court basically put the brakes on all of that and struck down all abortion laws of all 50 states, including the most liberal ones in the country, such as those of New York State. So the court took a step that was completely out of touch with where the culture was, where democracy was leading people, and it was based on assumptions about our culture that have proven to be wrong. And let me just say, Todd, I'm not saying that that if a voters decide that abortion is right, that that makes it morally right. I'm just saying that the court completely circumvented our political process.
Another political outcome that I've noted is that Roe has taken on a place in both American jurisprudence and also in American politics, something akin to a third rail. There are those who say, there are those who won't touch it or won't utter the word abortion. They'll use all sorts of code to talk about it among our politicians. But then there are also those on the pro-choice side who will argue that Roe is the ultimate right to which all other rights of both men and women must bow in the court of law.
Well, you're right about that, Todd. There's an argument that abortion is almost kind of a super right, that it's super protected above other rights, including free speech. In another case, the court decided an abortion case and struck down Nebraska's ban on partial birth abortion, and yet, on the other hand, upheld what amounted to a restriction on free speech in front of abortion clinics. So it's saying that even when it comes to free speech, which is explicitly in our Constitution, the court said, no, abortion still comes first. And anything that might cause a woman to change her mind about abortion is suspect, and the state has a right to stop it, to stop that kind of speech. So it is, you're right, it's just kind of a super right. We see the distortion of abortion in other areas of law, like I said, in free speech law, that seems whenever there is some possibility that a regulation may affect abortion, then the normal political rules and the normal legal rules are thrown out the window.
Another thing I noted in your essay that I had not been aware of with regard to Roe, you call it medical paternalism.
Yeah.
But the specific explanations on the part of the Roe court talk about the primary decision of abortion lying not with the woman, but with the doctor.
You know, and Todd, I think that's a part of the decision that many people have forgotten about. And that is that it's a very much a medical type decision. It almost reads like a hospital regulation when you get down to what the court actually decided. We have to remember that Justice Blackmun had been general counsel for the Mayo Clinic in some of his earlier years as an attorney. And when he was working on writing the opinion in Roe versus Wade, he went to the medical library at the Mayo Clinic to do some of his research. And that's too bad because a lot of his research was clearly inaccurate. But what he said was that the abortion decision is left to the medical judgment of the pregnant woman's attending physician. And he concluded that the abortion decision in all its aspects is primarily a medical decision, and that basic responsibility for it must rest with the physician. I think what he was envisioning was just, you know, one of these private consultations with a family doctor who's known the girl or the woman for a long time and is able to give her wise counsel. And I think he really has the Marcus Welby family doctor image. But that's nothing to be further from the truth, because abortions are not done by the family doctor. They're done in abortion clinics or abortion mills, if you will. And the woman does not have a consultation with her physician. In fact, rarely even knows his name. So it is no longer a medical decision, but that's what the court said it was, maybe in an effort to ease its own conscience.
We're talking about Roe v. Wade's view of women with Paige Comstock Cunningham. She's a senior fellow for the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity. Their website, by the way, is cbhd.org, cbhd.org. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. What has been the effect, if we look at Roe as the proverbial pebble in the pond, those concentric waves that have emanated out from there, in terms of the laws that have perhaps been thwarted, their progress made impossible by something like Roe v. Wade?
Well, let me just think mention a couple of those, and that is right after Roe versus Wade, we tried to see if there were any laws that protected the unborn child that would be held constitutional by the court. For example, requiring the abortionist to use the technique that was most likely to result in the live birth of a child. or requiring that there be a doctor present, a second doctor present, if abortion was done on a child that might be viable to take care of that child. These were just reasonable regulations trying to do whatever the state could to protect unborn children without unconstitutionally interfering with a woman's abortion decision. But in those early years, time after time after time, when we were before the court, those regulations were struck down. So regulations directly related to abortion were pretty much viewed with hostility by the court. Later on, we saw a little more openness, not because the court got any newfound wisdom, but because the membership of the court changed, and we had more reasonable justices considering these. But there's also an issue outside abortion, which I think people may not be as aware of, and that is protecting unborn children when the mother wants her child, when she has exercised her freedom or her right to choose to have the child. One of those is what we would call a fetal homicide law. And what that means is if somebody kills a pregnant woman and in that same assault her unborn child is killed, that there are two crimes and not just one. I think probably everybody's heard of Lacey and Connor Peterson, and that's an example of this kind of fetal homicide, that there is a crime against Lacey and a crime against her son, Connor, who died when his mother died. We now have a federal Unborn Victims of Violence Act to protect those unborn children when their mothers are injured or killed in a federal crime. But it's, you know, we've had to go state by state by state to say, wait a minute, if the woman wants her child, why should somebody else who kills that child be able to walk away scot-free? So that is an area where we've had to work very hard, because abortion activists and abortion supporters are afraid that if this kind of law gets on the books, that somehow it will jeopardize abortion rights, even though this has nothing to do with abortion.
Well, and legally, of course, it has nothing to do with abortion, but I think they are at least as perceptive as to realize that philosophically it has everything to do with abortion.
Well, it certainly does in terms of how society is going to view and treat and care for unborn children, really the most vulnerable members of society.
It makes the average person think about who the unborn is.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes the average person think about that circumstance in which an unborn child is killed in the commission of a crime.
Sure.
And it's not a big leap to connect the dots between that and the abortion clinic.
Well, it's not, and that's what they can't stand, because society cannot live with an inconsistency like that forever. And it's going to have to be resolved, and we believe it's going to be resolved on behalf of welcoming unborn children and no longer having them vulnerable to abortion. There's another really disturbing way that abortion, not just abortion law, but the whole abortion mentality has hurt women and families, and that is in the whole area of prenatal testing. That's become more and more common, and there are many, many more kinds of tests that can reveal whether or not your baby has a certain fetal defect. But the purpose of these tests is not to help parents better prepare for parenting a handicapped child, but it's really kind of a search-and-destroy mission. And if that child is shown to have some kind of fetal defect, the mother is frequently pressured, either indirectly or sometimes directly, to have an abortion.
How significant was Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the Supreme Court decision in 1992? Tell us about the decision itself and comment on its significance in the whole ongoing 30-year-long debate over Roe.
Sure, that's a very important case, Todd. As I mentioned earlier, people thought that the court might reverse Roe versus Wade or cut back on abortion rights. And it was a very close decision and a very divided court. What Planned Parenthood versus Casey involved was a statute from Pennsylvania that had a number of very reasonable common sense regulations, such as parental consent, a 24-hour waiting period for a woman to have to consider the information that she has been given, spousal notice, some record-keeping requirements. Just basic common sense regulations to say that, we need to keep track of abortion, and for those women who do have abortions, we are, wanting them to be treated with respect and dignity and not abused by the abortionist. What the court did was uphold all of the Pennsylvania regulations except for spousal notice. The husband still is a legal zero with respect to the abortion decision. But then it went out of its way to what we say is to reaffirm Roe versus Wade, basically saying Roe versus Wade is still the law of the land. But what is ironic is that all the legal arguments that we heard in Roe versus Wade disappeared from Casey. The medical tone that we talked about, the medical paternalism, that's not in Casey. The division of pregnancy into trimesters is not in Casey. The recognition of abortion as kind of a privacy right is not in Casey. So it rejected all the bad legal reasoning and all the bad legal arguments and replaced it with some new bad legal reasoning and bad legal arguments, but still saying that abortion is the law of the land.
So we're really in an era of Casey.
That's right. And the really frightening part of Casey is that it has opened the door to legalized infanticide. The court, just 8 years after Casey, rejected Nebraska's ban on partial birth abortion. And as the justices who dissented in that case said, you know, this is a barbaric procedure, and it's one that many state legislatures recognize as bordering on infanticide, that they take it very seriously. And yet the Supreme Court said, based on Casey, that the states could not prohibit this procedure unless it had an exception for the mother's health.
Paige, with only 1 minute before we have to wrap up, you have written, as long as abortion on demand remains legal and constitutional, women will continue to be isolated and exploited. With only 1 minute, explain what you mean.
That abortion is preventing us from finding creative, healthy, welcoming, wonderful alternatives to embrace not just women and their children, but whole families. And as long as it's seen as a woman's problem, then abortion will be seen as women's solution. And so I think it has really kept us from, as a culture, figuring out creative ways to welcome children in difficult circumstances and to support their families through institutions like the church, the schools, to prevent employers from discriminating against women. And it has just become the easy way out and the easy excuse.
Paige Comstock-Cunningham, thank you very much for being our guest. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Todd, and have a great afternoon.
Paige is Senior Fellow for the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity. Their website, by the way, cbhd.org, cbhd.org. That's the website for the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity. She is author of a chapter in this book, The Cost of Choice. Her chapter is titled The Supreme Court and the Creation of the Two-Dimensional Woman. When we come back from this break, we're going to spend some time talking with both Pam Fichter of Missouri Right to Life and then with Bill Beckman of Illinois Right to Life. We're going to do a little post-election analysis for both the state of Missouri and the state of Illinois. Well, Missouri went so solidly red and Illinois went so solidly, well, not so solidly, but still well into the blue category. We might have a little contrast there. We'll be talking about the state issues in the elections when we come back from this break. And then in the second hour of the program, Philip Karst will join us to talk about Roman Catholics who want to opt out of a health plan because of abortion and other related topics.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most talk radio shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you to pay the production salaries and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to prayerfully consider making a financial gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You can donate by credit card, 1-800-737-0172. Or you can donate by check, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend upon you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc.
Listen to this Global Minute so you can pray for people in India who live without hope in one of the world's most overwhelming slums. More than 1 million people struggle to survive poverty in the city of Mumbai. Women, their husbands and children who try to make money in backbreaking labor face constant challenges in India. The mission agency Gospel for Asia describes their tragic plight. They're not allowed to set up makeshift homes in nicer parts of the city, and they're banned from shopping areas and restaurants for fear that they'll drive down property values. But native missionaries are improving the quality of life among Mumbai's poorest by first sharing Christ's power and love. In addition, they tutor children and start medical clinics. Pray Christ's message of grace and power will transform more lives in the slums of Mumbai. Pray with knowledge and passion for unreached people around the world using the website missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Kristallnacht, the Night of Crystal. November 9th and 10th, 1938, when Nazi thugs torched Jewish synagogues. From Joseph Goebbels' diary, I see a blood-red glare in the sky. The synagogue burns from all over the Reich. Information is now flowing in. 50, then 70 synagogues are burning. The Führer has ordered that 20 to 30,000 Jews should immediately be arrested. In Berlin, 5, then 15 synagogues burn down. Now popular anger rages. It should be given free rein. Bravo, bravo! We who believe Israel's Messiah has come should hold the Jews in special regard, as did St. Paul. He said they are Israelites, God's adopted children. They have the Lord's glory, the pledges, Moses' teachings, the true worship, and the promises. The Messiah is descended from their ancestors according to his human nature. The Messiah is God over everything, forever blessed. Romans 9, 4 and 5. Spirit of God, we pray, by your word, extinguish any anti-Semitism that is in my heart. Amen. Thank you for listening. Remember this solemn day. I'm Dale Meyer.
That initial hype of newness dissipates in about 6 to 30 months.
On the next Focus on the Family.
And if we don't make the transfer into an intimate, deep connection with our spouse, then that passion dies.
Dr. James Dobson speaks with Cliff and Joyce Penner about marital sexuality and how couples can build stronger, long-lasting relationships. For mature audiences, on the next Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. For the remainder of this hour, we're going to be talking about local election, post-election analysis with both Pam Fichter of Missouri Right to Life and Bill Beckman of Illinois Right to Life. That'll round off this hour of the program. In the second hour, Philip Karst will join us to talk about the ability of some federal workers to opt out of their regular health care program and enroll in a health care program that doesn't cover abortion, contraceptives, and fertility treatments. That's of concern to many Christians, and I think in particular on the issue of contraception, to many Roman Catholics who work for the federal government. We'll be talking about that in the second hour. Then Seth Cooper will join us from the Discovery Institute. We'll talk about this federal trial in Atlanta over the constitutionality of a disclaimer sticker in textbooks about evolution. We'll follow that with a little audio that we got from the president's press conference on Thursday last week and a follow-up yesterday as McClellan answered a question about something the president had said in that press conference when he had been erroneously told that Yasser Arafat had passed away. We'll talk about that in the latter part of the second hour. In the third hour, Martin Nolan joins us to talk about Martin Chemnitz, whom the church remembers this day in its calendar. Pam Fichter is our guest. She's president of Missouri Right to Life. She joins us for Missouri post-election analysis. Pam, welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's start up at the federal level. The senatorial race at the federal level in Missouri. Tell us about what happened.
Well, Kit Bond was successful, and we're very, very pleased about that. And Kit will be back in the United States Senate doing the good pro-life work he's done since he's been there.
And will he have some more pro-life friends there in the Senate when he shows up for the next session?
Well, we picked up, five additional Senate seats in the for the Republican Party, and those tend to be pro-life, so we're certainly very hopeful that that will be the case, and they can go forward then with more pro-life legislation.
Will it constitute in the U.S. Senate a pro-life majority, or, I guess put more particularly, the kind of majority that's necessary to get things done in the Senate?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, particularly with the judgeship situation. I mean, there's some discussion on whether the rules of the Senate actually allow for a filibuster, because the Constitution says that the judges can be approved with a 51-vote majority, and when a filibuster is allowed, that requires 60 votes. So, you know, that seems to be the current practice of filibustering seems to go against what the constitutional requirements are for electing judges. So, you know, hopefully having the majority that they have will give them the confidence to maybe be more aggressive with that.
How committed is Senator Bond to the life issue?
Well, Senator Bond has a 100% record on pro-life issues, and you know, he's always been a friend of pro-life and has always worked very very consistently and very passionately for pro-life legislation.
How did the U.S. House races come out in Missouri?
Well, we elected Todd Akin, and, you know, that was a very welcome victory. However, there were some disappointments, most particularly in the 3rd District, with Russ Carnahan being elected over Bill Federer. Bill Federer had a last-minute, a late surge, I should say, because of the Jefferson County vote not coming in until later. But, you know, that was one that we were looking for an upset in, but that didn't happen. But in the except then with the 1st and the 3rd District, you know, we had good success for the congressional elections. Missouri Right to Life was particularly pleased with the success of our endorsed candidates on the state level. We had 93% of the candidates that our PAC endorsed in the state level were elected, and 86% of our endorsed candidates won in the House. So, you know, that's very gratifying to see that the voters of Missouri have confirmed the pro-life priority that we've always seen here.
One other question on now newly elected Representative Carnahan. What can be expected from him in terms of a pro-life record?
Well, you know, he's very pro-abortion. He's very anti-life on any legislation that involves a life issue. He has always taken the anti-life position. So, you know, we expect him to be consistent, and he will certainly not be a friend of life in the United States House of Representatives.
Before we get to the State House and the State Senate, let's talk about the governorship in Missouri.
Yes, well, Matt Blunt was victorious over Claire McCaskill, and Matt has a 100% voting record in Missouri and believes, and again, is opposed to abortion in most cases. Matt, we have some concern over his position on human cloning and embryonic stem cell research, but, you know, we look at someone who has the belief system that Matt Blunt has, and someone who does express a respect for the sanctity of human life, and we feel that that's certainly a good base to start from, that we need to communicate with him the scientific reality of stem cell research and cloning, and we're very hopeful that that the truth and his faith will lead him to the right position on that issue as well.
You're quoted up front on in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch Illinois edition, "Will the GOP Push Conservative Agenda," as saying that you believe conservatives helped deliver the victory to Matt Blunt, and you expect him to deliver. What does that mean?
Well, we expect results. You know, we work hard to elect pro-life candidates, and we certainly expect that when they're in Jefferson City that they're going to work hard to pass pro-life legislation. We're going to be working very hard this year to get a ban on all human cloning. We're also going to revisit a bill that builds in some civil liabilities for those who help minors cross state lines for abortion, most particularly for people who take minors from Missouri to Illinois. Because, as you know, in Illinois, there's no requirement for parental consent there. So, anyway, Senator John Loudon in Missouri has introduced that legislation for the last 2 years, and we know that Senator Loudon is going to pursue that again this year, and we think we're going to have a very good chance of getting that passed.
What would you highlight from the state house races by way of the pro-life victories of last week's election?
Well, I just think the numbers, you know, the fact that, you know, overall we had over, you know, when you average out our success rate, we had over 90% of the candidates that Missouri Right to Life PAC endorsed were elected. You know, that's a very big vote of confidence from Missouri voters, that, and also a great indication of the priority that they set for pro-life issues. Missouri is a bellwether state across the board, you know, whether we're looking at voting for President of the United States or whether we're passing pro-life legislation. And I think that the priorities that the Missouri voters have placed on this issue is indicated by the vote.
Now, let's talk about the Senate as well in the state of Missouri. How did that come out?
The Senate in the state of Missouri, well, again, we end up with a pro-life majority. We have we're going to have a 27 out of 34 senators are rated as pro-life, and that gives us a 79% pro-life majority in the Missouri Senate.
I'm looking at this, and the article in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch says, for the first time in more than 80 years, there is a Republican control of House, Senate, and the governor's office there in Jeff City. Now, all of the things being equal, does that necessarily translate into big steps forward in the next 4 years or so in Missouri for things like protecting a ban on partial birth abortion or other issues pertaining to life?
Oh, absolutely. You know, when you have to deal with a pro-abortion governor and then you have to deal with the possible override of a veto for any legislation to be successful, you know, that's a huge obstacle, and it takes a tremendous amount of effort and a tremendous amount of money. So when you have a governor that you think is that, you know, you're fairly certain is going to be friendly to the pro-life legislation that is passed, it certainly gives people a lot more confidence to go forward with that legislation, and you just don't have that obstacle to contend with. And then you also look at the appointment of judges and the other things that a pro-life governor can do. So, yes, we're very optimistic and very encouraged that we're going to be able to see a lot of success for pro-life legislation in Missouri.
Now, the newspaper article says parental consent, morning after contraception, and stem cell research being your top priorities, Missouri Right to Life's top priorities in terms of some kind of legislation. Of those three, if you had to place one as the highest priority or perhaps the most likely to get through, which one would it be?
Well, those are two different things. You know, the most likely to get through, I think Senator Loudoun's bill that builds in the civil liabilities, I think because that has already been debated a couple of years and people are fairly well educated on it, I think that's the most likely success. I think and it's certainly a high priority for us. The top priority is going to be to have a ban on all human cloning. And this is a kind of an uphill battle. We have a lot of money being spent on the other side with the biotech people lobbying the legislators to try to basically spread misinformation and to cloud the discussion of it with confusing terminology. So that's going to be our biggest battle, but I would have to say that is our highest priority. And then, of course, we work with our legislators on any pro-life legislation that they propose. We always follow, you know, the bills to provide taxpayer money to make sure that taxpayer funds are not going to providers of abortion. Last year, we followed over 45 bills. So it's not just what we set as a priority. It's what our legislators do after they get there, and we certainly will work with any of our pro-life people to help them with the legislation that they're interested in pursuing.
Do you agree with Claire McCaskill's Democratic campaign advisor who said in the story that Republicans have now lost their excuse not to act on moral issues since they can no longer blame the inaction on a Democratic governor?
Well, I think there's a lot of truth in that. You know, we're not always on the same page, and of course, we're not looking at this just as a Republican thing. You know, from Missouri Right to Life's perspective, we have a bipartisan pro-life majority in Jefferson City, you know, made up of a lot of good pro-life Democrats. So, you know, this isn't just an issue of a Republican and Democrat. You know, we look to work on a bipartisan manner to successfully pass pro-life legislation in the state. But it certainly does help when the party in leadership is a party that is committed to pro-life. So we certainly think that a lot of obstacles have been removed, you know, with the success of this past election.
What happened in the Missouri lieutenant governor's race, and how significant is that?
The lieutenant, well, Peter Kinder eked out a win there. You know, that was a very close race, and it went back and forth throughout the night. But Peter Kinder was ultimately successful. The only statewide candidate that we endorsed that was not successful was Catherine Hanaway, and that certainly was a heartbreaker for us. Catherine has a solid pro-life commitment and has shown her ability to be a leader in the state of Missouri, and has, you know, worked in the legislature for 6 years, so, and had served as Speaker of the House. And Catherine lost to, you know, a candidate who is very pro-abortion and been supported by all of the pro-abortion organizations such as NARAL and Emily's List. So Catherine Hanaway's loss to Robin Carnahan was the biggest disappointment in the statewide races.
And she was running for
Secretary of State.
Right. How significant is Secretary of State in the whole, you know, of all the elections we've talked about so far, how significant is that one for the pro-life agenda?
Well, you know, Secretary of State is not going to vote on pro-life legislation. So from that standpoint, it would not have had the impact of some other ones. But, you know, when you look at someone who is, you know, when you're looking to advance the career of anyone, you certainly want to advance the career of a pro-life candidate over a pro-abortion candidate. I wouldn't be at all surprised if Robin Carnahan didn't at some point pursue a run for the governor's mansion. So, and had Catherine Hanaway won, I would have expected that that might have been in her future as well, and might still be. I mean, I don't expect Catherine to go away. She's just too talented and has too much to offer the citizens of Missouri. Then I expect that she's going to find a spot where she can continue to be in public service. But again, you just don't want to see the political career of a pro-abortion candidate advance.
What about Missouri Attorney General?
Well, for Attorney General, that again was a disappointment, and I should have said that was another one of our endorsements that was not successful. I indicated before there was only one. That certainly is another one. Jay Nixon, who has not been a friend of pro-life, was reelected over the endorsed candidate Chris Byrd.
Are there any other races statewide that our listeners need to be aware of in Missouri?
Well, we you know, we have a seat to fill. Sarah Steelman, who is a senator, and I'm struggling here to come up with the district that she is in. But Sarah Steelman ran for and was elected state treasurer, and of course that means that she's vacated a Senate seat. So there will have to be a special election for her Senate district, so we look for that to come up. And there's a possibility there may be another vacancy in the state Senate with a senator that is possibly considering moving on. So we may have a couple of special elections to deal with, and we'll take those as they come and see who those candidates are, and certainly work to for the pro-life candidate in either of those races.
As a matter of curiosity, what is Governor-elect Blunt's faith?
Well, I'm not exactly sure. I know that he is a Protestant. I believe that, if I said I would be guessing, so I certainly don't want to do that over the air.
Pam Fichter, thank you very much for bringing this information, the post-election analysis for Missouri, to us here on Issues Etc.
Thank you so much for calling.
Pam is president of Missouri Right to Life. Their website, MissouriLife.org, MissouriLife.org. For the remainder of this hour, that's about 5-6 minutes here, Bill Beckman is our guest. He's executive director of Illinois Right to Life. We move across the river and do a little analysis of the statewide races that took place last week. Bill, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. Thank you very much.
Okay, let's start up at the top, and this is one that made the headlines, the Senate race in Illinois.
Certainly Alan Keyes did not look well in terms of the final results.
What do we expect from Barack Obama then as he heads out to Washington?
Well, based on his voting record in Illinois, unfortunately, he's got a very extremely liberal voting record, and I think that unfortunately he's not going to truly represent the people of Illinois, but he did manage to win their votes.
Some say that the loss of Alan Keyes to Barack Obama signals that the Republican Party in Illinois needs to basically ditch the social conservatives and move toward the middle, in particular this whole pro-life issue. What do you make of it?
Well, I think that that's really a self-serving argument, because the fact of the matter is that the whole situation in terms of Alan Keyes getting into the race was, first off, a late start coming from out of state. He continued to lack Republican organization support and funding. And I think his unique campaign style was something that certainly Illinoisans were not prepared for, and at this point didn't have enough knowledge of him to basically be able to respond to that. So all of those special factors have nothing to do with the underlying issues. We had success with Peter Fitzgerald 6 years ago, who was strongly a pro-life candidate. And we've had other cases where, and for example, Al Salvi, previous to 2 years to that, even though he lost the race, he ran a competitive race, and it was only because of certain gaffes in his campaign towards the end that it's probably that were the reasons that he lost that race. So I think overall the arguments that somehow judging from the Alan Keyes race would suggest we need to move towards the middle is not a correct conclusion.
Tell us about the positions of now the senior senator from Illinois, Senator Dick Durbin, on the life issue.
Dick Durbin is also very liberal. He's voted consistently, like 100% Planned Parenthood rating against life issues. And so, unfortunately, the state of Illinois is very poorly represented on the life issues by its two United States senators.
What would you highlight as significant in the U.S. House races in Illinois last week?
Well, unfortunately, we didn't lose a strong, pro-lifer, Phil Crane, and it was all the other incumbents won. There was some uniqueness to that race in terms of, and I believe that probably in 2 years the Republicans will have a good shot at winning that particular seat back. But Phil Crane was a long-term pro-life Republican, been in office for like 30 years. Maybe it was just the time for him to retire, but at least the voters apparently thought so in his own district.
So what about losses or gains in the Illinois House and Senate?
In the Illinois House and Senate, we basically picked up pro-life support, one seat in the Illinois Senate and two in the Illinois House. Now that leaves us actually with still a shortfall in terms of the Republicans are in the minority in both houses right now. That moves it to be 31-27 in the Illinois Senate with one independent, and it moves it to be 64-54. A Democratic majority in the House from previously a 66-52. So there is a movement in the direction towards the conservative positions and life positions, but not enough to change the actual leadership composition in either house of the Illinois legislature.
Will it mean any better chance in Illinois for passage of state laws that would in any way, I'm thinking about parental consent, I'm thinking about parental notification, any of these things have a chance in the foreseeable future in Illinois statewide?
It appears unlikely to me, because the track record of the leadership, the Democratic leadership in both houses of the Illinois legislature, is to take any bills like that and if necessary, even send them to committees that really are not even appropriate for the bill, just to make sure that they get killed in committee and don't even get to a vote on the floor. So with that kind of an adversarial position to not even give them a fair vote on the floor, it seems like that it's very unlikely that they're going to be able to get any bills like that anywhere along through the legislature.
Finally, Bill, is it a disadvantage to be a pro-life candidate in Illinois?
I do not believe that it is. If you do a head-to-head comparison on the voting patterns, and this doesn't seem to be any different in Illinois than it is in other states or in the national races, I was just looking at an analysis earlier today regarding the presidential race, where effectively that among those people who consider abortion or other life issues to be a key factor in their decision, the split is a 12% point advantage to the pro-life candidate. And maybe it's not quite 12% in Illinois, but it's certainly definitely an advantage to the pro-life candidate if they're clear on their views and they're not viewed as basically being wishy-washy. In other words, if they stand up for principles and they make it very clear that they're for those principles, that's an advantage to them. Now, that doesn't show up in the Allen Keyes race because there's too many other factors, as I mentioned before, that just effectively distort that race completely from the norm.
With only 30 seconds, was Illinois, people have the perception that up north in the Chicago area, it's going to be a pro-choice vote. Down south, southern Illinois, it's going to be primarily a pro-life vote. Does it actually shake out that way?
Well, I mean, it's a Democratic vote versus a Republican vote. I mean, I don't think it's truly a pro-life or pro-abortion vote. 80% of the city of Chicago voted for John Kerry for president. I mean, that's a huge number. But a lot of those voters are not pro-abortion. They're voting for other reasons, and in fact, primarily because they're Democrats and they vote for Democrats. And hopefully we can manage to find a way to reach them on life issues and change things. But
Bill Beckman, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Okay, thank you very much, Todd.
Bill Beckman, Executive Director of Illinois Right to Life. Their website, illinoisrighttolife.org. illinoisrighttolife.org. Now, you can see here from the very first hour of Issues Etc., we talk about defending life from beginning to end. It's not only rhetoric, and it's not only cheerleading, and it's not only talking about the broad philosophical things, and it's not only talking about particulars. Here in the first hour, we brought you the facts from both Missouri and Illinois in the post-election analysis. We also, in that first half hour, went into some great depth in analyzing Roe v. Wade, a critique of Roe v. Wade as law and as a cultural anomaly. This is what we bring you here on Issues Etc., defending life from beginning to end with the breadth and a depth that you very seldom will hear elsewhere. Help continue and expand this function of Issues Etc. by becoming a member of our Reformation Club. It's our monthly donor program at the level of a confessor, an apologist, or a reformer. $25 a month or a year-end gift of $250. That's the confessor. $50 a month or a year-end gift of $500. That's the apologist. Or at the reformer level, $100 a month or a year-end gift of $1,000. You help Issues Etc. defend life from beginning to end. We have 69 members now. Our goal for the end of the year is 100 members. Call 1-800-737-0172. That's our automated resource line, or write us at Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. You can also donate online by going to our website, issuesetc.org. issuesetc.org. When you click on the What's New section, you will find a way to become a member of our Issues Etc. Reformation Club at the level of the confessor, the apologist, or the reformer. When we come back for the second hour, Philip Karst will join us to talk about federal workers trying to opt out of their health care program for moral reasons. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.